The people who are careless about Bitcoin security are exactly destroying Bitcoin, because it will not have value if there are so many security incidents. Like currently there are so many Bitcoin thefts, etc. It will only grow in value if it can be shown to be reasonably secure.
Hello, welcome to episode 17 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. In this episode, you'll hear me interview Yoshi Goto of Bitmain, makers of the Antminer. As I found out, Yoshi is a really serious force in the world of Bitcoin mining. I also talked to outspoken cryptographer Nicolas Coutois, who has a bunch of very impressive credentials and just as many critiques about Bitcoin. And finally, I talked to Sean Wilkinson, who has become well known for his storage project. All these interviews took place at the 2015 Texas Bitcoin Conference, the same conference where Sean's storage project won the hackathon just a short year ago. I'm here at the Bitmain booth, and I guess you must be Yoshi?
Yes.
Hi, Yoshi.
Hi.
I've been walking around, and I've talked to a few other booths. We got the Oregon Mines over there, and there's another, I guess, Bitcoin miner over there. So you've got the Antminer, which I've heard of. And that's pretty good for me because I'm really out of the mining scene. So, but your company's name is actually Bitmain?
Yes, the Bitmain is the company name, and Antminer is one of our brand.
When did Bitmain start?
The Bitmain started in 2013 when the hash rate was start climbing.
And that was when there was a lot of problems with like Butterfly Labs and.
Yes.
A lot. I just remember just getting into Bitcoin in 2013 and
yes.
Hearing about all these people waiting and their Bitcoin was skyrocketing the value,
yes.
But they'd lost all of it.
Yes.
I guess you guys have delivered.
Our business model is no pre-orders. Our company will put up the capital investment, produce the miners, produce the chip first, then produce the miners and take orders and ship the product usually 2 days after the payment.
Okay, so you don't accept money before you have something to ship.
Yes.
That's a good policy. So I'm looking at these units, and they're kind of a big block, it looks like.
Yes.
Are these self-contained mining units?
Yes. What we learned throughout the Bitcoin mining process is there's a lot of DIY type. You have to put everything together. So many chances of failure or a thing doesn't work. So what we decided to do is create one-stop solution. Since we produce the chip, we decided to put mining gear together, and including a OS. It's a Linux-based OS. So when
Winix?
It's a Linux-based.
Linux. Okay.
Yes.
So basically, I just plug this. I'm trying to look for the
plug the power plug on the top,
uh-huh.
And then internet cable, the Ethernet cable. One end go to the miner, and the other end will go right into your internet router or the switch, and it will start mining.
Okay, so I have to have my own power supply, it
yes.
looks like. Okay, so that's it. Do you guys sell the power supplies too? Or
Not at this point. We did produce a Bitmain power supply specific for Bitcoin mining, and now we're producing a second generation to be more stable, so we can actually release it to the public for public purchase.
Now, you produce your own ASICs also?
The Bitmain is the ASIC designing house that produce our own ASIC.
Oh, wow.
Specific
so
for Bitcoin mining.
That seems like a big deal to me. What goes into designing and having your own ASIC manufactured?
Our ASIC engineers has years of experience already programming for other ASIC. And it takes a group of 15, 20 engineers working on so many different projects just to make that one tiny 28 nano chip, and takes months in preparation.
So when you first launched your first miner, was it with your own chips originally?
Yes.
Also?
The Bitmain's first Antminer S1 came out in October of 2013.
Uh-huh.
And then now we're on sixth generation miner.
So can you compare the hash rates of the original versus your
yes.
newest?
Back in October 2013, our unit was 180 gigahash. Today on S5, fifth generation miner, 1,150, almost 8-9 times stronger.
And is the power consumption about the same, or
no,
is it more?
back then the power consumption was 2 watt per gigahash. We shrink it to 0.5 watt per gigahash, one fourth of the power consumption.
So overall, though, it would consume more power, but you obviously are getting a lot more hashes out of that. So what would be the entry level for a current generation chip?
The actual entire mining machine, the price is $340 US.
$340?
Yes.
Wait, not for this.
This is.
This only is $340?
Yes. We don't overcharge customers with outrageous Bitcoin mining hardware price. Our retail, we cater both retail market and also B2B. And our idea is let's treat the B2C market as any other traditional electronic merchandise.
So there's not like a wholesale price. This you're giving that basically bottom
price?
For
the retail customer, have to pay retail pricing. But B2C price is almost the same as the retail.
Okay.
But we don't come up with a crazy, outrageous price to enter in mining.
So that was the price I would pay if I were to buy this. Wow. So, and again, I have no idea what anyone else charges. But just looking at this unit, I was guessing thousands of dollars. Again, no idea. But so that sounds like a pretty good deal.
Yes. I'm sure if we mark it up that much, customer will still pay for. But then we're not helping any decentralizing Bitcoin mining, because our company's primary focus is decentralize as much as we can on Bitcoin mining to spread around the world, not centralized mining.
So that's interesting. I guess there's nothing to stop a big farm from just buying a bunch of your units too, though, right?
Yes.
Out of curiosity, what are some of like the biggest orders? How big do they get?
As some customers are buying these by thousands at a time. And the Bitcoin mining-wise, there are a few public mining pool, and there's a pool called antpool.com, is world number one largest mining pool, which is owned and managed by our company, Bitmain.
Wow, I had no idea. So you said public mining. There's private pools also? I mean, I don't know the definitions of the difference.
In the past, when the Bitcoin first came out, it was so easy to mine Bitcoin using your home computers, PC or Mac or Linux, and you were able to mine. Nowadays, the difficulty skyrocketed with the CPU mining, went into GPU mining, and then ASIC mining now.
Sure, I'll skip ahead. I mean, I understand the purpose for pools, because there's no way you're going to be successful unless you have a lot. I just didn't know. You said there are public and private pools?
The public pool is basically anybody who wants to mine Bitcoin but don't have enough hashing power on their own to do solo mining, and they can join any publicly available pool and publicize on the internet.
I mean, you have to do that, basically, right?
Nowadays, you almost have to do that.
So I guess I'm just trying to understand, like, I've heard about some of the pools getting really big and everyone worries about 51% attack. Your pool is just equivalent to one of these other pools that they,
Our pool is not as big as 50%. It's still 16, 18
so
percentile.
So when you said you had one of the biggest, or the biggest pool, then how is it the biggest but not the biggest hash rate percentage-wise, I guess?
The hash rate-wise, we are the largest, but right now we're keeping it right around 18, 19 percentile out of 100% chart.
18% of the hash rate is coming from your pool?
Coming from our antpool.com.
Well, that's pretty impressive.
Yes.
So that's really cool. Is there anything else, since I don't know enough about mining to ask the intelligent questions, you want to say about your units?
Sure. With the Bitcoin mining, it's getting harder and harder. What we recommend is there's so many hype out there still that people are chasing for the future chip, that's a dream that currently doesn't exist, and investing quarter mil, go with the one that's in the market now that can ship, because the difficulties, no one knows what the difficulty will be in even 3 weeks from now, and what the Bitcoin price would be a month from now. So it's a lesser risk to be able to do in-stock hardware to do Bitcoin mining, then you don't have to experience with what happened a year ago with many other ASIC manufacturers.
Okay, and now I'm really interested, because next to us we have
AirBits.
Well, no, no. This gentleman here, he spoke yesterday. He's a cryptographer.
Oh, yes.
Who is quite skeptical of, and I'm really curious to see him interested in your unit. So I'm going to, without even pausing, maybe when he's done writing stuff down, talk to him. And and I would think he would not be having any interest in miners with his talk yesterday.
Yes.
Are you familiar with his talks?
Yes.
Okay. I was not, and I found it very interesting, but... hi, can we switch over and interview you real quick? I saw your talk yesterday.
Yes.
So you have a few minutes?
Yes.
And I'm forgetting your name.
So I'm Nicolas Courtois. So I'm a researcher in Bitcoin and cryptography. I work at University College London.
You had a lot of, scary negative things to say about Bitcoin. I watched your presentation, and you seem to have a lot of credentials. Do you want to kind of paraphrase just in a few minutes some of your criticisms of the Bitcoin network?
Well, I think Bitcoin community has worked in a total disconnection with the professional security community, and especially cryptography, which is somewhat bizarre. I mean, every day we hear in cryptography we trust, but there is very little space for actual cryptography. So cryptography has standards and best practices. And the Bitcoin community has been somewhat avoiding to apply the most fundamental best practices which are known in crypto community. So there has been a divorce between Bitcoin community and crypto community, which is very bizarre. I mean, people should be working closely together, and Bitcoin should be exposed to criticism from people who have been doing cryptography for decades for the industry and as a research venture.
So you were saying yesterday that there were no cryptographers, I guess, hired by the Bitcoin Foundation, or you were saying something to that effect?
Yeah, that's a fact. I mean, if you look at Ethereum, they have on their board at least two, if not three, prominent cryptographers, because you can also consider that Vitalik has gained some serious authority in applied cryptography. So they have Ralph Merkel, which is one of the inventors of the public cryptography behind Bitcoin, and also of hash trees, which are used in Bitcoin. And they have Koblitz, which is another very famous cryptographer and inventor of the elliptic curves, which again is a sort of cryptography which underpins Bitcoin. So Ethereum are doing a good job at, you know, canalizing the energy of well-known cryptography experts. In Bitcoin, there has been somewhat which does look like almost a deliberate attempt not to do the job in a professional way.
And why would they be deliberately?
It looks like, you know, a sort of class struggle. We don't want to talk to cryptographers. We don't want to employ them. There are many companies who just don't like cryptographers. We don't need them. You know, we just use some cryptography, but we don't want cryptographers. So it could be something like this, you know. It could be just the question of the culture, you know.
So you don't believe some of the people who are highly involved in technical have enough expertise in the real basics of cryptography to be doing what a professional cryptographer would be doing, I guess, as far as standards and such?
Yes, I think there is a necessity for the Bitcoin community to reconnect with professional cryptography community so that we can align, the most basic things to be implemented and used. It also is about software updates. There is a number of solutions such as RFC 6979, which was adopted in Bitcoin software and elsewhere with up to 18 months delay. So therefore, you know, I think the Bitcoin community was too conservative also in fixing the problems they themselves already identified, and clearly the fix was there, is there in the software, but they have been very sluggish in applying these fixes.
Okay. One of the things I thought was interesting was you expressed a lot of doubts about the SHA-256 algorithm being used by Bitcoin.
I think nobody knows if SHA-256 is secure, but it's a matter of fact that SHA-256 was not yet extensively studied. I mean, the reasons why people use a crypto algorithm such as AES, for example, is that almost every code breaker on our planet has extensively tried to break it, and the guarantee that it's actually secure, it comes from the fact that they have failed so far to break it. Or in the elliptic curves, the guarantee comes from the fact that there are cash prices for scientists to break these things, and therefore, you know, if they could break it, they would claim the price. So there is some guarantee. If you are using substandard cryptography, which is currently used in Bitcoin, then you have less guarantees and you are more fragile, and it's difficult to sell your system as a fully professional system because it uses non-standard cryptography.
I couldn't tell if you were kind of implying that like the recent loss at Bitstamp could have somehow been due to the algorithm.
Yes, so there have been a number of high-profile thefts of Bitcoins recently. Some of these are clearly already explained by bad random events. Some additional ones might be in the future explained by the attacks which I have published last year in October. So they are combination attacks. But there is also a number of totally mysterious events which nobody can explain at this moment. So I don't know if they are going to be elucidated or not. I'm certainly working on this question at this moment.
So, I mean, I think everyone's aware of the attacks when there's a bad random number generated. Was there another attack?
Yes, so we have extended tremendously the applicability of bad random generated attacks, and this research is still going to be published soon, so not everything has been yet disclosed. We have shown a variety of ways to apply these attacks into a much larger number of wallets than initially thought.
Do you have goals with speaking about the flaws in Bitcoin? Are you interested in Bitcoin and want to see it be stronger? Or I'm just curious where you're coming from.
Yes. I do believe that something like Bitcoin needs to have like an army. So, you know, we don't need the government anymore. We don't need the banker anymore with their, you know, traditional standing and trust. So it's possible to somewhat build trustless systems, but you still have to trust cryptography and cryptographers. And you need to have something like defensive armed forces which defend this territory against hackers and also against like rogue developers who would embed backdoors in some systems and so on. So this is still something which you need. So as long as Bitcoin does not have a larger a group of people who are actively engaged in defending it by, for example, promoting better security standards, then it's going to remain weak and fragile, so it could collapse overnight just because something has been overlooked.
So you don't hate Bitcoin?
Absolutely not.
Okay. So I guess if there were to be a decision made that the SHA-256 algorithm being used isn't safe, every single wallet would have to, you'd have to transfer the value, I guess, because it's been created with that algorithm, right?
No. Because, you know, SHA-256 could be phased out progressively, and it would make sense for a professional system to use several sorts of cryptographic primitives simultaneously, several crypto suites, so that basically you became agile and you actually can upgrade if something bad happens.
I guess I'm just thinking about, say people's paper wallets they have in cold storage.
Yes, so you could keep it backwards compatible, but you will still be limiting the exposure in the future. So in the future, the number of people exposed to an attack would diminish.
So if it really came to light a way to attack that algorithm, then those paper wallets we all think are so safe in our safe deposit boxes maybe aren't as safe as we think then.
Well, they are probably very safe because Satoshi did something really brilliant. He started hashing public keys, and therefore, if your public key is not revealed, and if you don't use some HD solutions which could make it more fragile, but so in many cases, actually, your paper wallets could be secure in the future, that you are the mainstream current of paper wallets which did not have additional vulnerabilities.
The blockchain knows every public key if you've put any value in it, right?
Well, that's the brilliant thing which Satoshi did in Bitcoin. Basically, Bitcoin protocol does conceal the public keys until the very last moment, except for people who use their keys many times. If you use your key many, many times, unhappily, your public key is known.
I've got a paper wallet, and I can go on the blockchain info and see the value there.
Yes, but if you go to the blockchain with your Bitcoin address, this Bitcoin address absolutely does not reveal your public key. It only reveals the hash of your public key in most cases. If you have done nothing to reveal your public key, like spending part of your money previously, then actually you could keep your public key secret for a very, very long time. And therefore, the window for the attacker to hack it in the future will be extremely low because he will have to hack it like within 5 seconds after the moment you have revealed your public key, because after 5 seconds, you may already transfer this money elsewhere to another fresh account.
Okay. On my paper wallet, there's something that says public key and something that says private key. So that public key is not the actual public key. It's some hash of the public key?
Typically, if your wallet shows you the public key, it could be the actual public key. But if it's the Bitcoin address, something written in base 58, which has all these strange characters, this will not reveal your public key. So as long as your public key has not been yet used, so that you have spent some money from this particular key, if you have not yet spent any money from this particular fresh account, then actually this is even protecting like against the NSA. Imagine the NSA could break these keys. Even themselves, they would not be able to do it like in 5 seconds. So therefore, it's possible by a certain policy to impose on users to use Bitcoin in such a way, they would be protected against some very, very advanced attacks in the future just by hiding their public keys.
This seems like a big learning moment for me because so that address is not my public key probably. That all, you know, there's all these online paper wallet generators and stuff, so I assume they're using the system that would protect my public key too, you're saying?
Well, if you use paper wallets, again, you could protect your public key and you should not reveal it unless you actually use this particular paper wallet. And then when you use it, you should not leave any money on it at all, but transfer to a fresh paper wallet.
Yeah, no, I understand that best practice, definitely. Great. Well, thanks for teaching me something, and I'm glad you don't hate Bitcoin. And are you hoping to maybe be hired to help strengthen Bitcoin? Or?
So I am a Bitcoin activist. I run a regular Bitcoin seminar in central London. So it's very hard to claim that I hate Bitcoin.
Okay. Well, I almost would have thought you did listening to your talk yesterday, but then I saw you, you know, looking at these ant miners and stuff, and I thought, no, he must not if he's curious about these.
Yeah, but
units.
You know, it's the same thing like with US dollar. Actually, the people who are careless about Bitcoin security are exactly destroying Bitcoin because it will not have value if there are so many security incidents. Like, currently, there are so many Bitcoin thefts, etc. It will only grow in value if it can be shown to be reasonably secure.
Okay, and
in practice.
And my last thing I'm going to do, I'm going to defend my friend Joho, as I would pronounce it before I learned. I might be one of the only people at the conference who actually spoke to him. I don't know if you've ever listened to my podcast with Joho, but he seemed like a really good guy. You know, he's a researcher at a German university, and I felt that your talk, you seemed to think he was recommending HD wallets because he was wanting to wait for another random number issue to steal people's Bitcoin. Was that kind of what you were saying, or was that just kind of a not really serious comment?
Yeah, I think it was a bit provocative on my behalf. But the thing is that Joho clearly cannot claim to have acted ethically because he has programmed the scripts to steal Bitcoins as soon as they could be stolen. And then suddenly he discovered, oh, I have so many. It's impossible to imagine that he could have imagined in advance that his scripts are going to obtain so many Bitcoins. It happened all of a sudden. So then he decided to return these Bitcoins. But you see, being there and stealing Bitcoins as soon as they can, I think it's ethically problematic. Even if you are a security researcher, and even if you are going to return this money, at this moment you have some social responsibility to give people well-informed advice. So I think Joho has somewhat mismanaged his media appearances to maybe give a slightly wrong message. And it almost looked like he was promoting a certain solution, such as Trezor, which is a good thing. But again, it looks like he's promoting this particular solution while there are other solutions also on the market.
There's a lot of coverage of my thing where he talked about using a Trezor, but I would like you to listen to my podcast with Joho, which is
okay,
how he says his
great,
name.
Great, yes.
Because obviously everything you say could be right, but I think you'll get a sense. I think he's pretty pure of heart. He's a mathematician, I think, and computer scientist, not a security researcher. So I think he just found an interest. It wasn't just with the blockchain hacks. I mean, originally it was with the bad random number generator with the Android, and then also after that was with he actually admitted on my podcast that he got in return some when counterparty had a bad random number generator issue too. So I'm just defending my guy. So
yes, but you see, my obligation is to criticize people.
Sure.
You know, because I need we need to attract the public attention to the fact that, you know, this sort of statements have big consequences. So therefore, you know, they need to be well balanced, and you have to think what the consequences of this sort of advice could be.
Yeah. Well, I think he was speaking off the cuff, and after hearing your criticism, he might go, "Oh, yeah, that's probably right." He seems like a pretty humble guy to me.
Oh, well,
I don't think he was trying to really make a.
Well,
big.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. Yes.
So,
yes. Yes.
We'll see. Maybe once I get this on, I'll send him a link to this, and he can hear it or your your speech.
Okay. Well, why not?
Yeah, why not? Well, I appreciate you talking to me. I did really find your talk fascinating. Anyone who's a cryptographer, I feel like we should be listening to.
I think it's important that we can discuss these questions.
Sure. And I'm glad you don't hate Bitcoin. All right, thanks for talking, Nicholas.
Okay, yes. Thanks for asking.
All right, bye-bye. Here, I'll come back with Yoshi now. What'd you think of that? You seem to be shaking your head like you agreed with Nicholas quite a bit there.
Good point. A lot of good points.
Yeah, okay, and I'm glad he doesn't hate Bitcoin.
Yes.
I thought... they just wanted to have someone who was really down on Bitcoin, but he just wants to make it more secure, so that's good.
More secure is better for longevity, to be able to implement the Bitcoin for longer term.
Were you interested to hear what he had to say there?
Yeah,
I was too. So, anyway, well, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
And I'll keep an eye on the Antminer pool size and make sure that doesn't get too close to 50%, please.
We will not do that.
All right, thanks so much.
All right, thanks.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Carrie, and I'm here to tell you about something really powerful that's happening. Nepal recently suffered a tragic earthquake. Thousands of lives were lost, and people around the world are wanting to help. Fortunately, Red Cross has opened a Bitcoin wallet with ChangeTip and is now accepting Bitcoin donations. In just a matter of days, thousands of dollars have poured into this account, turning Bitcoins into food and supplies for those in need. With ChangeTip, we can send Bitcoins through Twitter and use our social platforms to build momentum towards giving. We can give any amount, no matter how small, and together, it really adds up. So, to open an account, go to changetip.com. There, you can buy Bitcoins or transfer from your Bitcoin wallet. Start giving, and if you want, redirect the gifts people give you to go to Red Cross. Let's use these amazing tools we've created to pull each other up and show the world the value of Bitcoin through generosity.
Today's magic word is work. W-O-R-K. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's listener distribution of LTB Coin on letstalkbitcoin.com.
What is this silly Bitcoin?
Today's sponsor is Bitcoin Keychains by bkeychain.com. You've seen these keychains on dozens and dozens of websites. It's about time you had one of your own. These substantial metal keychains make great conversation starters, and they make great gifts to or from Bitcoiners. You can find a list of retailers at bkeychain.com, several of whom support Bitcoin so much they won't even accept fiat currency. And of course, you'll always get the best deal from these retailers. So what are you waiting for? Go to bkeychain.com.
I'm here with Sean Wilkinson, the developer behind Storge, and I just was there for your talk. I've got a podcast called The Bitcoin Game. I'm on the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network, and I first heard of you actually when you were on Let's Talk Bitcoin last year. And I guess, was that after the hackathon?
Yeah, I think so. That would make sense. Yeah, I think it's after the hackathon, because the hackathon was the first time we announced the project publicly, so I'd assume that... that would be after.
Okay, that would make sense. So, and I haven't gone back there to see the hackathon. What's the hackathon like?
It's pretty pretty fun. So they got maybe 10 teams hacking away and coding some stuff up. So they have some interesting projects back there. Some interesting projects.
Oh, I should get back there because I guess the next storage could be back there right now, huh?
Yeah. So there's actually a team that's working on some decentralized data stuff. So let's see if they see what they come up with.
I'm not even clear how these things work. Are you supposed to be like coding from scratch, or do you come in with a bunch of code?
So
or?
Based on the rules for this hackathon, you can either come with an idea or you can come with essentially some stuff that you worked on before. So it's pretty open. It just depends on, I guess, the hackathons and the rules. But this one's pretty open.
How long were you working on your idea for storage before the hackathon?
Probably about 3 months prior. So I was working with BitShares, and then I kind of branched off and did my own project.
Okay, I forgot about that.
Yeah, so I did a little thought stuff and did a little coding before I came to the competition, so I was a little bit prepared on what I was going to do.
Storage is huge now, I feel like, in the crypto space.
So we went from a tiny little hackathon project to raising about $500,000 via crowdfunding.
You got a little bit of my Bitcoin for that?
Yep. So I hope you're throwing away all your Bitcoins for storage coins as the Bitcoin price goes into the ground. But it always goes up and down. I've been around since 2012, so.
You had said you were mining.
Yeah, I was mining in 2012. I was getting a nice half Bitcoin a day off my little rig, but not anymore.
And at the time, though, that must not have felt very impressive.
No. It was like a dollar. But now it is. I wish I'd mine a little bit more than I did.
I'm sure. What were the first things you did with your Bitcoin, you think?
I think I bought like a VPN service and maybe some web hosting. That's
so that was a while after you were mining, probably.
I had a couple of Bitcoins and I spent a few of them. Wish I hadn't, but hey, all good and dandy when you're helping the Bitcoin economy.
So where are you based out of?
So I'm in Atlanta, but we have a completely distributed team. So we have people in Europe, people in Australia, people in Asia, everywhere. So.
Okay. Well, I've got to admit, you're a charismatic person.
I try to be.
You know? Do real good on stage. Out of everybody here, you seem like one of the most relaxed, kind of fun people.
If you're not excited about what you're doing and your project is, how is anyone else going to be excited about it? So, I mean, I'm pretty excited to be pushing a platform that allows people access to their data where only they can control and they can access it. And something that's a lot cheaper than traditional storage and offers a lot of tangible benefits. So it's good both on the business side. You know, it's something that I use myself instead of Dropbox, who's, you know, watching all my files and doing whatever else with it. But it's also cheaper. On the other side of that, I have plenty of extra hard drive space. It'd be really cool if I could sell that and actually earn some money. So, you know, I have a bunch of storage coins saved up for myself to use in the test group. So,
you were mentioning that you thought it would be a lot of times maybe college students who don't have to pay for their infrastructure. I guess sometimes I feel like I don't have all the bandwidth and stuff. Would I be a candidate, you think, for...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can set the parameters, and that depends on how much you earn. So at the end of the day, you just want more archival storage, and you don't want to use that much bandwidth, that's fine. So you download the file, it's probably some backup or something that someone may never, ever need to access again, but they want it stored, you know, just in case. So you choose those kind of contracts and download those to your machine, so it'll just be a one-and-done kind of thing. And you audit every once and again to make sure it's there.
And I did find it interesting that you're really thinking more of the big organizations as driving this.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, users don't pay for storage, right? You get Dropbox, Google Drive, you get it for free. So on the user side, we're more turning that around. Well, we can't beat free, but we can pay for it. Now, that's an interesting value proposition. And the other side, the business is paying arm and leg for storage. So, I mean, if you're looking at something like EMC, your business using that, I've seen as high as $5,000 a terabyte.
Wow.
So imagine you got your little, if you could sell it to that business more directly, everything being equal, you can get a terabyte drive for $60. So even if we did it at half the cost that EMC was doing and provided those same value-added services by our network, that's a nice little chunk of change that you could bring in on your side. So we're really trying to start our reward process in Test Group B. That's starting up pretty soon. You have to have storage coins to be able to participate in that. But we're going to start trying that out and try that market basis and see how this all works out. We have some ideas on how it should work, but we're all about testing those ideas on small scale, actually running the software, saying, that works, that doesn't work, and supplementing our ideas with actual data. So that's how we're building the software out. So there's not going to be a magical release, but small scale is the way to build something like this out.
Is there basically just a hash that goes on the blockchain that's securing all the data? Where's all the
So essentially, it's a hash challenge. So it's a challenge response. The idea is that you're hosting my file. I want to make sure that you're hosting my file. So I give you a challenge that I know in advance. And so you do some mathematics with the challenge I gave you plus the file that you have, and you give me back a response. And you can only give me back the correct response if you have my file.
Okay. So how does the blockchain involve?
So the blockchain is involved in a variety of methods. One is payments. So if I want to pay 500 people at once simultaneously, the only way I can do that is through blockchain technology. The other portion is audits. So the idea is that we want to audit this information constantly, and so we use the public ledger to keep track of that. We're not storing any of the data in there, but we're using the blockchain to keep track of that data.
Now, did I see you're going to be working with Factum in some way?
Yes, yeah. So we share a couple of team members. I've known Paul and David and some other guys on the team for quite a while now. So we have some integration with them in terms of we do data storage, but they can do data notarization. So that can work really well together. Let's say you have a court system where you want to make sure that the data is not modified when it's received, recording, video, audio, whatever. You want to make sure it's not tampered with. Well, you can store it on the storage system and then essentially notarize it with Factum. So we're very open to collaboration with them, and we're talking to them from the very beginning. So I like to say that I knew about Factum before it was cool, when it was called Notary Chains.
I believe I was the first media to cover Factum. When I started my podcast, I was like, well, this seems really interesting, yeah. And no one seems to know about it. I had no idea they were about to, you know, go really big.
Yeah, it's been in Paul's head for more than a year. It was just under a different name. So we're excited about it. It has some good use cases inside of the storage network.
I always hear about a connection with MadeSafe, too. What was that connection?
So that connection is towards the beginning of the project. After we won first place in the hackathon, the Texas Bitcoin Conference here, mm-hmm. 1 year ago. So we were working with David and the BitAngels to kind of do our due diligence, look around, do some research. And that's when we kind of bumped into MadeSafe. So from that discussion and that talk, they kind of got into the crypto space. So we've been talking to them from the day one that they came into the crypto space. So we like what they're doing.
But what would your relationship be? How would you guys
work
together?
So a lot of people peg us as competitors, and that's not accurate at all. I mean, at the end of the day, we're taking two different approaches to the same problem. And so I see some approaches that they're taking and we're taking, but who knows which one's the best approach. So I see more of a mixed application, a mixed protocol where you can add in a little bit of storage, a little bit of MadeSafe, a little bit of Filecoin, a little bit of Sciacoin, all these different protocols that are taking different technical approaches to the same problem. And when you combine them, you get a much better system with way more advantages than disadvantages than trying to separate them. I mean, at the end of the day, it's open source software, so you just write a wrapper to combine the two.
Interesting. So I can't help but address that must be Google Glass on you.
Yes, I am wearing Google Glass.
Is that something you're just loving, or is just?
Yeah. So it is my prescription glasses. So I've been playing around with it for about a year and a half. So far.
Okay, so is it just something you just keep on there, or are you accessing that all the time?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I already always have like a phone or a computer out, so me relying on this, I already have a screen out, so not too much.
Okay, so it's more just sitting there most of the time?
Well, it is my glasses. Like, it is all one unit, so I don't have a choice.
Okay, all righty. I didn't know if it was almost a statement that you are really into tech or...
Maybe a little bit. It is part of my brand a little bit, right? So they're like Sean the Google Glass guy. So I get more questions about it when I take, when I don't have it than I have it on. So you're like, where's your Google Glass?
Well, great. It's a pleasure to meet you. You seem like one of the rock stars now in this space. So really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Definitely, definitely.
All right. All right. Well, I'll see you throughout the rest of the conference.
All right. See you around. BitToy.
Thanks for listening to episode 17 of The Bitcoin Game. I provide links to just about everything discussed in these podcasts, so if you want to follow up on anything, just look in the show notes for this episode on letstalkbitcoin.com. Stay tuned to upcoming episodes of The Bitcoin Game for even more interviews from the Texas Bitcoin Conference, as well as from the more recent State of Digital Money Conference held in Los Angeles. Please let me know you listen by following or tweeting to The BTC Game on Twitter, or by commenting on this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. You can find a listing of all episodes of The Bitcoin Game by going to thebitcoingame.com. See you next time.